please extend a warm welcome to our speaker, Ms. Betty Gold.
Thank you, Mr. Lynch. Thank you very much.
Excuse me, can everybody hear?
No. I'll stay close. Okay.
And you're here now.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Very good.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me. It's my pleasure to be here. And I'm really honored and with all the accolades and all the hospitality that you've shown me. I'm very pleased to be here. Thank you very much again. My name is Betty Gold, and I'm a Holocaust survivor. I lived in a very small town in eastern Poland. It is the Ukraine now. And it was a very unique town because we were all Jews, 5,000 Jews, and only one Christian family, the postmistress, her husband, and son. And we lived very nice lives, not like you Americans at that time, but perfectly comfortable. We had our own land. We grew our own, you know, vegetables, potatoes, and so forth. We were very self-sufficient. We had a little bit of retail. We had school. We had teachers. We had a doctor. We had really very nice community, and we were a very religious community, and everyone was either a neighbor or a relative, and we lived very humble lives. And then, of course, the war broke out, and when the Germans invaded Poland, we didn't expect anything evil. We didn't expect anything to happen to us. And then we heard that people from the big cities, Jews, were being killed, and that they'll probably come and kill us also. But my parents and all the other elderly people, they probably were in their 30s or 40s, and they were rather in denial. And, you know, at that time we were living under the Russian occupation. And a lot of refugees who came from Warsaw ghettos in the big cities, and they ran away because from the killings. And they came to us, and we were planting seeds. It was like in the spring. And they looked at us and they said, why are you doing that? You'll never live to enjoy the fruits of your labor. And our parents, you know, they were in denial. They said, they're probably hurting the Jews in the big cities because they're sophisticated people, and they probably didn't follow the orders of the government and so forth. Now, why would they bother us? And we continued living our normal lives. At that time, my father had a brainstorm, and he thought, just in case it's true that they will come to kill us also, he's going to build a hiding place for his family. We had a shed in the back of our home. It was long and narrow, and he decided to build a false wall in there. Of course, he didn't tell us where it was or anything, because they didn't want us to tell other kids, and they would tell other people. And of course, it was going to be a hiding place, so we didn't want to. They didn't want to advertise it. And in addition to that, because we lived very close to the Rajino Forest, my father and his adult cousin decided to go to the forest and dig two bunkers. So should we survive in the wall, we'll have a place to hide. And in the meantime, that was the plan. And things were pretty quiet. They didn't bother us. They took a few men for slave labor, and they never returned back, obviously. But they didn't kill anyone for a long, long time. And we were hoping for the best. And one day, we got up, and our town was surrounded with Germans and uniformed Nazis with rifles on their backs. And there were, surprisingly, there were some locals who helped them out, and they surrounded our town. We were instructed to take with us whatever we can carry in our person, a bundle or a little suitcase. And of course, we were so scared, and we followed instructions, and we took little bundles. And I was walking with my grandmother, and they instructed us to go to the center of town where there was a park, and to be seated there and wait for further instructions. I was walking, and of course they were escorting us with rifles. And as I was walking with my grandmother, and we both arrived into the park, and of course they were gathering all the 5,000 Jews there, and they were formed, they were forming a ghetto. And it took a long time for 5,000 Jews to be escorted to the ghetto. And I was sitting there with my grandmother, that was my father's mother, and I was watching the people coming forward, and they were escorted with guns and rifles, and all the adults and babies and children. And I noticed suddenly, after a while, that my parents and my two brothers were not forthcoming. Where were they? I didn't wait till all the people arrived, and I decided to do something very risky. I told my grandmother to watch the bundles, and I said, I'm going to go back home. She says, you're crazy, they'll kill you. How can you go back? Everybody's coming this way, and the Nazis are coming this way, and the rifles like this. How are you going to get through? I said, I'll take a chance. I was very small, and I was kind of quick on my feet. And I risked my life at that time, and somehow I managed to get through. It was a miracle. And I came to my house, and there was no one there. And then it dawned on me that they must be in the wall. I came into the shed, I identified myself, and I asked them to please let me in. There was no response. And the reason they didn't respond to me is because they were afraid that someone followed me or someone will hear me. And instead of 16 people being killed, there were 16 people in the wall, it's better to sacrifice one child to save 16 people. And they wouldn't let me in. I started to cry and beg and plead, and I kept saying, I also want to live. Please, how can you not let me in? Please. And I was begging, and to no avail. But suddenly, a little door in the corner of the wall, like on the floor, opened up, and an arm reached out. I grabbed the arm, and they pulled me in. And we were 17 people now in the wall. And there were two families, my parents and my two brothers and I, and my father's cousin, his wife, their three children, two little boys, 6 and 4, and a little girl, 1.5 years, and some other extended members of the family. And we were instructed, us children were instructed not to cough, not to sneeze, not to talk, just to be very, very quiet, because a lot of the Nazis were roaming around in the courtyards looking for hidden Jews who didn't come to the ghetto. Maybe they were hiding on their beds or places in the attics. So they were looking for a lot of them. And there was a little hole in the wall we could peek out. And we saw some Nazi drag out my mother's mother, my grandmother, who was at the time was about 74 years old, and they shot her right in the courtyard because they found her hiding. So we had to be very quiet, and we were. But a little girl who was about 1 1/2, maybe a little bit older, started to cry. And she became hysterical. We couldn't stop her. The mother tried to hug her and kiss her and comfort her to no avail. And we knew for certain that we'll be heard, and her cries will be heard by the Nazis from the ground, and we'll all be killed. But we had no choice. So we were praying. In the meantime, the mother made a decision. She wanted to save her two little boys and the rest of us. She suffocated the baby to death. Now, us children had to watch this. And we thought that, God, should we by mistake happen to cough or sneeze, they'll do the same to us. It's a memory that will never leave me, that I will never forget. It is probably the worst experience I've witnessed in my life. And we continued sitting in the wall, waiting till nightfall so we could get out and go to the forest and climb into the bunker. And we were waiting and waiting, and suddenly we heard shots. It sounded like a war. It was terrible. It lasted for a couple of hours or more. That's when they killed all the Jews in the ghetto. If I hadn't escaped, of course, I wouldn't be here tonight with you. We were in the wall, and we waited for nightfall so we can crawl out, and we were blessed with a rainstorm, and it created a lot of noise between the shrubs and the trees and the vegetation, and there were ditches like on the side of the shed. We crawled out, and on our hands and knees, we were crawling until it was a safe distance for us to stand up. And we stood up, and we ran real fast towards our bunker in the forest. We came there, we crawled in, and that's where we lived for a long time. It was like September, it was still warm, so we were grateful because we had nothing with us except the clothes that we ran away with, and it was lightweight clothing because it was still warm outside. So it wasn't so bad. And then there was a problem because we got hungry and we didn't know what to do. It was very, very dangerous to go out looking for food. In the meantime, they appointed me to be the person to go out and scrounge for food. The reason for it is because every Jewish male that is born is circumcised on the eighth day. And if any of the boys or the men would go out and some locals or Nazis who were wandering around would notice them, the first thing they would ask is to pull their pants down. When they noticed they were circumcised, they would kill them right on the spot. So everybody felt that they were taking a better chance with me going out for food. I was little, I had a babushka, and of course most of the time I went out at night. Where did I get my food? I would steal from farms, it was still kind of warm. I would steal from barns, sometimes I would find a little flour or wheat, or whatever. I would steal from garbage containers. They didn't have the same kind we have here now. There were wooden containers. And I would just put my hand in and whatever edibles that was they threw away, I would pull it out. I had a big cloth with me, and whatever I could scrounge out, I would put it in that cloth and tie it around my neck and walk back at night and bring back whatever I could gather up. Now when I would bring it back, my father would ration it. everybody got a little piece each day, or a little bit of whatever I brought, because he didn't want to risk his little girl getting killed, till for me to go out as often, so the food had to last long enough, just enough to survive, that's all we got. And that's how we continued living in the bunker. And of course, eventually it got cold, and then there were lice that were eating us up. And of course, the hunger, misery, started losing a lot of weight. We were very, very lucky that my father had a wonderful, wonderful, close Christian friend, a Polish friend. He did business with him. And he was the only one that he trusted with our whereabouts. He was the only one who knew where we were hiding. And he would come and visit us every month, every 3 weeks, because he risked his life to do that. Not only his life. If he were caught, he would be killed and his family would be killed. So you must imagine what a wonderful person, human being he was. We call them the righteous Christians who are honored in Israel at a memorial. It's called Yad Vashem. And he was honored there too. His name is there. And he would come, and he was also our bulletin. He would tell us what's going on with the war, what's happening in town, although we had no town. When they killed the Jews, they burned all the homes. It was flat. We watched it burning as we went. And we continued living like that. One day he came and he told us, you know what? There's some survivors. Not all Jews were killed. Some of them ran away and they were hidden in bars, they were hidden in attics, they were just wandering in the forest. And some few were hidden by Christians. And they are going back to town. There were two houses left on the outskirts of the town, and they were going to go there. And the Germans are using them for slave labor. And boy, what a wonderful idea that was. We were so pleased. We said, oh my goodness, they'll probably have a soup kitchen, we'll have shelter. And we decided to go back also. And of course, we started walking at nightfall. And mind you, my parents, my grandparents, and my great-grandparents were born in that town, in a little town. They knew their way around for hundreds of miles. That night, we couldn't find our way to town. We were getting lost. My parents, my adult cousins, we couldn't find our way. We walked and walked and walked to no avail. Finally, we were so exhausted and so tired, my father said there was a ditch here. We're going to crawl into the ditch. We're going to sit there until dawn, till daylight. Then we'll know, we'll find our way to town. And we did. We sat down. We were sitting there and waiting and resting. And suddenly we heard shots. Again, like a war. And all the people who came back to town to the two houses were slaughtered again. If we hadn't gotten lost, again, it would be with you. So it was another miracle that happened. And we didn't know what to do. Turn around, and we went back to the second bunker, because we were afraid that while we left that bunker, we won't know if someone spotted us. So we went to the second bunker, and we crawled in there, and we were miserable. It was already cold. There was snow on the ground. We women, I had pigtails. My father had a very dull knife. He cut my hair off three at a time or something. It was so painful. And all the women's hair was cut up. And because of the lice, we would put our hands in the snow to freeze them. so he wouldn't itch so much. Our whole body of him was scratching constantly. And we were so hungry and so tired. And we played games, you know, to entertain ourselves. At times we had a sense of humor, kept us going. And then some of the games were like, we asked my brother, Bernie, if you survived this, what would you do? What would you eat? And he would say maybe, oh, I would eat 100 pounds of potatoes. And the other person would say, I would eat 10 loaves of bread. And everyone mentioned what they would eat, you know. And we were drooling at the same time while we mentioned the kind of foods, the different kind of foods. And it was just a dream, of course. And we continued living there. One day, our dear friend, Yusef, his name was Yusef, came and he said, I have bad news for you. You were spotted. And you're going to be killed this afternoon. You must run away. You must leave. And you know where to go. Where do you go? It's cold, it's winter, it's... Well, anyway, we thanked him. And my father knew of another bunker that housed 11 Jews. They were hiding in it. He says, they were about a mile and a half from us. He says, I know what we'll do. We'll go to the bunker where the 11 Jews are hiding, and we'll stay with them. And then we'll decide the next day what to do. He gathered us up, and we walked, and we came there. He lifted up the little cover of the bunker. The cover was as big, maybe twice as big as this. It was just a bunch of little twigs with leaves on top. We lifted it up. We identified ourselves. We told them our story. And they said, take a look. If you find room, you're welcome to come in to join us. Their bunker was smaller than ours. We could sit up in our bunker. They could not, they could just lie down. We took a look. There wasn't room for an arm or a leg. They were squeezed so tightly like sardines. When one turned over, everybody had you. We didn't know what to do. There really wasn't room for us. We turned around and we decided to go back to the bunker. Because at that time, suicide became a very attractive option. We were just too hungry and too cold and too miserable to live. And we decided, so we'll die together. We'll go back to the bunker, let them come and kill us. We went to the bunker, we crawled in, and my father said, listen, everybody, surely we're going to be killed this afternoon. Now, I want you to listen to me. When they come, when the Nazis come to kill us, I want you all, when we crawl out and get us out, I want you all to run. Do not stop. It's easier to get killed while running. For two reasons, he told us that. Because, first of all, if we run, maybe someone will survive. And he told us that we'll meet at a designated place. And the most important reason why he told us to run is if we get killed while we're running, it's nothing, it's an easy death. But if they keep us, if we don't run, we stay there, they will torture us. And that's what they used to do when they were found hidden Jews in the forest or anywhere, especially in the forest. Because we witnessed that. Once in a while we'd crawl out and we saw that. When they found a hidden Jew in the forest, they wouldn't kill him. They would torture them. They would cut women's breasts off. They would cut ears off and tongues and fingers. We watched them hanging on trees, hidden Jews that the Nazis found. And that's why my father told us to run. so we won't be tortured. And maybe by chance someone will survive. Well, we were waiting. Everyone hugged each other, said goodbye to each other, we'll see each other in heaven. And we were waiting quietly. We heard the footsteps. They were coming. My younger brother was right next to the little cover of the bunker. We told him to look out to see who's there, as though we didn't know. He looked out, and he turned around, and he smirked, like that. What's going on? Instead of it being the Nazis, it was a friendly Christian. Another miracle, right? He had good news and bad news for us. The good news was we were not spotted at all. The 11 Jews in the other bunker were spotted. They were all slaughtered. If they would have had room for us, again, I keep repeating, I wouldn't be at your falls tonight. Life became unbearable. And once again, I still continued scrounging for food. I still continued trying to, it was hard because it was winter, it wasn't much available. But whatever I could find in the garbage cans and in the barns, and I brought back, and we were skeletons already at that time. Anyway, we didn't know how many of us will die from hunger. Anybody who was strong and big and healthy died from starvation. Any Jews who were in hiding, they didn't have enough food to survive. And somehow, the little bit that I was able to bring back to the bunker, we managed. One day, one night, I should say, I never went out during the day, I came into a barn to look for something, maybe a little wheat, maybe a little flour, whatever. And all of a sudden, there's a like a table, an old table, and I see three loaves of bread. My God, I mean, God sent me such a gift. I became overwhelmed. I can't begin to tell you what. I grabbed the three loaves of bread. I ran back to the bunker. I was so happy. I couldn't wait to see how surprised my family will be when they see me come in with three loaves of bread. I crawled into the bunker with three loaves of bread. Their eyes were bulging out. They were drooling. They couldn't wait to get a piece. And everybody was so happy. And you know what a New Year's Eve party is? Okay. However, my father said, not so fast. These three loaves of bread are going to have to last us for a few weeks, a couple weeks. So Benny doesn't have to go out as often for a little while. He took a loaf of bread, and with the dull knife that he had, he got a little piece like this, like a half a hand. And each day he would give us a little bit, a little piece. So he rationed it so it would last, just enough to survive. So his little girl could live a little longer, maybe. And he built like a shelf. He didn't build a shelf, he dug a shelf in the bunker where the breads were housed. I was lying next to the breads. And that night I thought to myself, what the heck? I'm the one who risks her life. I'm the one who feeds everybody. Because of me, they're alive. I deserve a little more, don't you think so? And I decided to poke a hole in one of the breads and suck on it. It was to make it last. It was so good. And I wasn't satisfied, of course, and I poked a hole in one of the other breads. I did the same thing. I felt very guilty, but I felt I deserved it. And that was it. In the morning, my father looked around. And he looked around and he saw two holes and two breads. And he says, oh my God, in addition to the misery, the cold, and the hunger, and the lice, now we have rats. And what can you do for rats, for mice? We don't have mouse traps. I didn't say a word. I kept quiet. I felt terrible, but I just kept quiet. All people go away. Next night, I did the same thing. I really felt terrible to steal like that. And they weren't big pieces. They were really little tiny pieces. Little times. I was 11 years old already at that time. My fingers were very tiny. But I did it again. The next morning, my father looked around again. He checked on the breads, and he said, "Oh my God, I can't believe it. Maybe we should eat the breads up, because otherwise the mice will." And he looked around and looked around and looked up next to the breads. And somehow his eyes caught mine. And he kept looking at me. I didn't know why. And the longer he looked at me, the more my eyes were bulging and the guilt on my face, I became like frozen, you know? And he stared at me and stared, and then he made an announcement and he said, "I think I found a rat." He took me over from one end of the bunker to the other. You know, it's a sense of humor there. It's a little bit of laughter. It's a little bit of I don't know what. But these are memories that I built in the forest. The bread lasted a couple weeks. My father made sure that I didn't eat them up. And we continued living that way. And then, one day, it was already the next year. It was the holiest day of the year in the Jewish religion. It was the holiest day. Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur. Maybe some of you are familiar with our holiday of Yom Kippur. It's a day where you go to the temple and you pray all day and you fast. It's, like I said, children, adults, everybody, the Reformed or the Conservative, not to mention the Orthodox, even the Gnostics come to the temple to pray on that day. And you know, wherever Jews were, they always gathered, whether if you were on vacation, they found each other, whether you were in wherever, on the cruise, so Jews found each other, and on that day they were praying. And sure enough, hidden Jews, there were still many, out of the 5,000 at that time, there were 4,200 killed originally in the ghetto, and then there were the second killing, there were about 300 killed, so there were some Jews who managed to run away each time. So, but there's still survivors hiding in different places. And they thought the same way we did. It's Day of Atonement. I think it would be safe, my father said, I think it would be safe for us to go and stay in the two houses to pray. Because we had a leather factory that was burned. We had a glass factory that was burned. Every house was burned. There were no Jews left. Why would the Nazis be there? There was no one left to kill. So we were certain we'd be safe. So we came to pray into the two houses. And many other hidden Jews had the same idea. And I would say there were about 180 of us in the two houses. And we prayed at night to pray. And in the morning, we started to pray. And we looked around out the window. The Nazis were so clever. They had the same idea. They knew if there are any Jews left, they will gather to pray. And don't you think they surrounded the two houses again for the third killing? My father said, "Kids, they're going to kill us again. I want you, I'm going to throw you all out of the window and I want you to run." We were always on the run. No matter what, we always had to run. "I want you to run, don't stop for anything or anybody. If somebody survives, you'll meet at this and this place." And he threw the children, he threw us all out the window, and the adults left through the doors. We ran out, and the bullets were flying in from every direction, like flying beans. And everybody was running. In the meantime, I saw my wounded uncle reaching out for help. He was bleeding to death. I saw a rabbi whose beard was on fire. I saw my classmates lying there dead. Do you remember the mother who suffocated her baby to save her other two little boys? They were gunned down, so they didn't have any more children. Out of the 17 people, 9 of us were left at that time. We met at a certain spot in the forest. We didn't know where to go anymore. We were afraid to go back to the bunker because we were gone. Who knows who spotted it? And my father said that, I keep mentioning my father. He had a lot of hindsight, and he was such a loving man and always caring about his family. He was like the leader of the group. And he said, the only place left for us is a swamp. There's a swamp deep in the forest. And I don't think the Nazis will go there. It was this deep, he says, in vegetation and mud and water. I don't think he said that the Nazis will dirty their gorgeous uniforms to look for a few filthy Jews in the swamp. We'll go there. How do you live in a swamp? We went deep in the swamp. The man gathered fallen trees. They built a bridge above the water from fallen trees and twigs and leaves. And at that time, it was already that summer. It was like May, I think, end of May. So we were happy. I mean, we had no shoes anymore. Our clothes were in shreds, practically naked. And we walked. We came to the bridge, to the center or someplace. And my father, they started to build the bridge. And we lived on the bridge for a long time. With the birds and the bees and the snakes, they became our pets. And there was a big problem then, because how do I go out scrounging for food from the swamp? I mean, it was this deep. This time I was up to my waste and mud and water and vegetation. How will I go out and get food for everybody or whatever a little bit? Well, I had no choice. We had to survive somehow. We drank the dirty, filthy water from the swamp. I went out. I used to go at night again. I would see my way to the village because there were little blinking lights. They didn't have electricity, but they had those gas lamps like we had in our town. So I could see little flickering lights when I came again in the swamp and the forest. And I would go and scrounge food again and wherever I could find it, and garbage cans, and maybe sometimes I would see an orchard and there was rotten fruit on the ground from last fall. I would find that and I would carry it with my shawl back, and I could find my way out, like I said, but I couldn't find my way back. It was just like 100 miles of swamp. I didn't know where to start. We set up a signal. When I came into the swamp back, I would clap my hand. I would clap 3 times. And they would clap back to me. I would follow the sound, and that's how I would find my way back to the bridge. And whatever little bit I brought, of course, little pieces of little, we shared it and kept going. At that time, we were literally skeletons. After months, my father said, especially to the children, He said, "I'm going to take you on a field trip." "What? On a field trip? In the swamp?
Where are you going to take us?"
He said, "We're going to walk to the end of the forest. And we're going to look out and see. Maybe we'll see human beings or animals. It'll be nice. It'll be a nice trip. It was sunny. It was warmer." And he took us all, and we followed him to the end, first to the end of the swamp, and then to the end of the forest. And we looked out, and he says, "This is going to be for 5 minutes. This is a treat." And we looked out, and sure enough, we saw farmers, we saw ladies with aprons, we saw children, we saw cows and horses, and cats and dogs. It was like going to the zoo. It was amazing, and we stood there with envy, and we envied these people and the animals. We wished we were one of the animals, so we too could be free. And of course, wishful thinking. And as we were ready to go back to the bridge, my younger brother suddenly points his arm and he says, "Oh my God, there's an orchard over there. I'm going to get some fruit. Maybe there's some on the ground." And before my father was able to stop him, he took off. Now it was certain death, because if anybody would spot him, they'd kill him. We were praying for his safety. We were praying that he'll come back right away and nobody will notice him. And as we stood there and waited for him and prayed for him, we suddenly saw three horses with uniformed soldiers and rifles. They approached my younger brother. They picked him up. They put him on a horse. And surely he was a kid. And they asked him, I'm sure they asked him, "Who are you? What are you doing here alone? And who are you with? Where are they?" And he told them everything. And we saw the horses coming towards us. We started to run. Horses run faster than people, I found out. They surrounded us. And that was the miracle of all miracles. Instead of it being Nazis, I would be surprised to know that it was the Russian underground, the partisans. I became a member of the Russian underground. I was a soldier too, and the rest of us 9 people. And I lived with the Russian underground as did my family for 6 months, and we went from forest to forest, and they had tents, and they had made fires, and my mother was a cook, and I was the assistant cook, and they traveled from place to place to blow up bridges, and buildings, and railroad tracks. That's what the underground did. And my father was very pleased that he could participate in that. My older brother was already 17, but they sent him to the Russian front. And unfortunately, he was killed 2 months before the war was over. They sent eventually my father to Kiev, to the capital of the Ukraine, which was occupied by the Russians at the time, and to work in a leather factory, a military factory, because that's what he did at home. He worked with leather. And they sent my mother and me to Russia to work on a collective farm. And we were picking potatoes for the Russian soldiers. And they allowed us to have one potato per person a day. That was it. And life was difficult, but we felt safe. The war was not over, however. The bombs were still falling. And we didn't know where my father was. We didn't know where my brother was, my older brother. And eventually, it's a long story. I don't want to take up too much of your time. But eventually, my mother decided on the collective farm that I'm going to dig out my military hat that every partisan had, and it had a little felt red stripe, which identified me as a Russian soldier. And I would have maybe special privileges. And she decided I will go to Kiev and find my father. It's only a city of 3 million people. I'm 12 years old, 12 and a half. But, you know, in our time, we listen to our elders. Some of our children run away from home. We didn't run by choice. We did what we were told to do. I put on my military hat. I went to the railroad station. And I that was jammed with soldiers. And I thought, wow, they'll see my partisan hat. They'll welcome me in the train. It's no avail, it's no room. I sat on the steps of the train. The wind was tearing my face apart. I held onto the railings of the train. And I was traveling. I was traveling a whole night like that, half a day to Kiev. And I could hardly hold on anymore. My hands were sores and blisters and my face was ripped from the wind. I got to Kiev eventually. I came there and then I started looking for my dad. And I decided I'd go to every government building first, because wherever there was a red flag, it meant it's a government, communist office, military office maybe. And I walked my feet off, I walked from building to building, wherever there was a flag. And I thought, because it was sent to a military factory, maybe they would know where there is a military leather factory. Nobody knew. And I walked the first day and walked to no avail. No progress. So I had a little bit of food with me and a few things to eat. I slept in the park and I got up the next day and I brushed myself off and there was a bench and I sat down for a little bit. I ate something and I started to walk the streets again. I was a street walker at the age of 12. And I started to walk the streets again looking for my dad. And again, no luck. I was so tired. I ran to the park and I lay down and I slept and got up in the morning and decided, this is the last day, I can't do it anymore. And I was hungry, I didn't have any more food. I started begging. People were nice, they would give me a little bit of food. And somebody would give me bread or a boiled egg or an apple or something. And I decided this is going to be my last day. I can't walk anymore, and I'm not successful. And I'm sure my mother will understand and forgive me. And I got up the third day, and I started to do the last day of my search. And of course, I didn't find them. I came back to the park. I sat down on a little bench to rest, and I decided in the morning I'll go back to the railroad, to the railroad station, and go back. I sat down on the bench that morning, and all of a sudden, you know, at my age, maybe the man was 45, 50, he was an old man. And I thought to myself, this little old man sitting next to me, I spoke Russian because I lived during the Russian occupation in the Ukraine, in Poland. So I went to school, I spoke Russian. And he suddenly asked me, what are you doing here, little girl? And so forth, you know, today you wouldn't talk to a strange man, but that time I was so pleased somebody talked to me. We didn't know about things that happened today. And he started talking to me in Russian, and he asked me what I'm doing here alone in the park with my little bundle. And I told him the story. I was looking for my father. I couldn't find him. And I'm going back to the collective farm. And I told him my story. And he listens. He's very kind. And he says, little girl, give me my hand. Give me your hand. You wouldn't give your hand to a stranger, now. I did. And he took me to my father. He knew exactly where the leather factory was. It was about 300 feet from the bench that I was sitting at. I found my father, and I brought him back with me. At that time, my older brother was killed already, so we didn't know. We found out after the war that he was killed. And we were reunited. And in 1945, the Russians passed a law that all Polish citizens can go back to Poland. Well, we didn't have where to go. We didn't have a house. We didn't have a town. We didn't have anything. But we came back. And we came back to the closest town, to the closest city from our town. And other survivors showed up too, showed up there also. And we were waiting. We didn't know what to wait for. We couldn't leave and we couldn't stay and we didn't know what was going to happen to us. But at least we had food. We had food. And did we attack the food? And did we get sick? For months and months with boils and all sorts of disease. And some of us were hospitalized for months because our bodies couldn't handle couldn't digest or handle the food we attacked. And how we were praying for it, and then we got sick from it. But eventually some Jewish organization, and I don't remember who they were, snuck us across many boundaries, like Polish, and it was illegal at that time. And Czechoslovakia, and West Germany, and they brought us to Austria. And we were placed in a displaced persons camp. And it was occupied by the Americans, that part of Austria. And it was in a town called Linz. And the camp was called Binderbichl. And there was a soup kitchen for us, and they had a little school for the young people, the young kids, and there were a lot of displaced persons that came from all over the country, from even Siberia, from everywhere, and it was one of the displaced persons camps, and I don't remember how many we were, about a few hundred, maybe 400 or 500 people. Refugees, but we were happy because we were safe. And the American soldiers were wonderful. They would give us candy, and they would give the adult man cigarettes. And they, you know, they had pity on us. They were really nice. And we waited till somebody would have us. Nobody wanted us. We thought we'll go to Cuba, to South America, to America. There was no state of Israel. There was Palestine, and the British were occupying Palestine. And they wouldn't have us, if you remember. The Exodus, the ship of refugees, they turned them away. Remember the movie or the book with Paul Newman? So we waited to see what happens. In the meantime, my father remembered, my mother had two sisters and a brother in Cleveland. And my father remembered part of their address. He couldn't spell it, he didn't know. I don't know, he put down numbers, it was probably part of their phone number, who knows what he put down. And he only knew the name in the Cleveland Heights. He wrote down Harry Abrams, Cleveland Heights. Ohio. I want to tell you something. They received the telegram. At that time, Cleveland Heights was a smaller community, so someone decent telegraph union? What was it?
Western Union.
Western Union, thank you. I forgot already. Was kind enough to look it up in a phone book or. And don't you think they delivered the telegram to Harry Abrams in Cleveland Heights? They sent us a visa. We advised them that four of us survived, and they sent us a visa. And we came in September 1946. We arrived in the United States. We were 2 weeks at Ellis Island. And then my family, my mother's family came and they brought us to Cleveland, to the beautiful city of Cleveland. And it was such a joy. We were so overwhelmed. We came here. My father had $9 because he had a little gold coin with him that he saved throughout the war. That's all we had from home. And he sold it to somebody on the ship for $9. We came here with $9. We were the happiest people in the world. At the same time, we were very sad also. My father went to work a week after we got here. Our family got him a job in a leather factory. Lever's Luggage, it was called, on 21st and Superior in Cleveland. My mother got a job. And my brother and I were enrolled in school right away. We got part-time jobs. We worked every single day after school till 9 o'clock in the evening, and Saturdays and Sundays. And then we would come home, and then in the week we would split our little paycheck with our parents to help them out, because they didn't make much. And I made 55 cents an hour, and my brother made 65, because he was a man. Got a dying word to me. I was mad, but I was happy to have it. And eventually we were in school, and eventually we worked ourselves up little by little. My father saved a little money. He went to the bank, he borrowed a little, he saved up $2,000, he borrowed. I don't know how much more you needed for a down payment than a little house. And he bought a little house, and then he bought a bigger house, and he went into real estate. And he became, pretty nice. Comfortable. He made a comfortable living. We had our own house, and we graduated school. We went to college. I became a nursery school teacher. At that time, we only needed a two-year degree. Now you need a four-year. I went to Fenn College, and we got married. We had children. I had 3 sons, and I have 4 grandsons. And it's not only that I survived, my family survived, and that my and everything that's evil, we have to speak up. And I feel that as long as I'm alive, I will do this and hopefully avoid another Holocaust. I want to thank you so much for inviting me, for listening to me. And I'm just so pleased to be here to tell my story. I am, like I said, I'm not a speaker, I just talk. And I will be very happy to answer any questions that you would like me to answer. Thank you all for listening.
How old were you when you came to America?
When I came to America, I was a little over 14 years old, 14 and a half. Yes?
What was the name of your town and the name of the forest?
Okay, the name of the forest was Rogersville Forest. Anybody? I don't know if you've heard of Lee Rogersville or Prince Rogersville.
Sure.
There was Mrs. Kennedy's. Jacqueline Kennedy's sister, she was married to Prince Radziwill in Poland. And Prince Radziwill had a huge mansion where we lived, about 3 miles away. He owned all the land and the forest. And it was called Prince Radziwill. That was his name. Okay, the name of my town. My town had two names, the Polish name and the Jewish name. The Polish name is Zofiówka. That's the Polish name. The Jewish name, it was well known for the Jewish name, more than the Polish name, was called Trachtenberg. Because the first two settlers who settled there were two men. One was named Trachten and one was named Broad. That's how the name came about. Now, there was also a book written by an author, a young author who's a descendant, a grandchild from our town. And he wrote, Everything is Illuminated. And there was also a movie shown on that day, it can be rented, called Everything is Illuminated. And it was about my journey back to Trachtenberg. The author took the journey, but it's the same journey that I took, with the same driver, with the same dog, with the same guide, with the same, going through the same countryside, and going to Trachtenberg, and to pay respect to the victims. I've been there the first time 9 years ago, with a group of survivors, and then we built, we went back 2 years ago, with a group of, there were just a couple survived, few survivors because we all died, and some second generation children and grandchildren. We went back and we built a monument in honor of the victims in the mass grave. And we built a wall around the fence around it. And we're going back this August. There'll be 108 of us, the organization that I organize, worldwide, from South America descendants, like second generation, third generation Trachtenberg people, from Israel, and from the United States. And we're going there again. Last time I went, I took my two sons with me. So we want to keep the memory alive. That's another reason why I'm talking. There's going to be a documentary that we're doing. There's going to be a book about our town.
Well, I gotta say this.
It has been our pleasure to have you here and to share with us what we call living history.